with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm spending time talking about a new biography I highly recommend, Ronald Reagan, His Life and Legend by Max Boot. All these years later, it's good to review what we lived through, we boomers. And you Gen Xers, you were children, and you Gen Zers, you weren't here yet. But this is the man that everybody rolls their eyes and goes, Ronald Reagan, the great communicator. Well, he was. He knew how to tell stories. But when you meet foreign policy, the stories only go as far as what happens later. It's surprising to me, Max, how many of these challenges in the two terms of Ronald Reagan are still with us. Iran, still with us. Afghanistan, still with us. The troubles in the Caribbean, Havana, Nicaragua. El Salvador seems to be solved, but Central America is not. Still with us. It's only 40 years. Poland is somewhat solved. That was a major challenge because it was under the Soviet boot. Let's talk about the Soviets. Ronald Reagan had no patience whatsoever with communism. And yet, he became a person who wanted, it's not détente, it's not Richard Nixon's détente. He goes back and forth between being confrontational and looking to do business about treaties. How should we think about him in the Soviet Union?
Well, I would say that in his first term, he had a somewhat muddled and unsuccessful policy towards the Soviet Union. The most high-profile elements were his confrontational tactics and rhetoric. He boosted U.S. defense spending massively. He called the Soviet Union an evil empire. But he was also at the same time behind the scenes trying to reach out to the Soviets and trying to establish channels of communication because he was very worried about the danger of nuclear Armageddon. That was something that, in fact, was an obsession with him. But as he later complained, you know, I wanted to meet with the Soviet leader, but they kept dying on me. And during his first term, he dealt with these decrepit geriatric leaders like Brezhnev and then Andropov and Chernenko. And things only really began to turn around with this policy towards the Soviet Union in 1985 when the younger and more dynamic Mikhail Gorbachev came to office. Gorbachev was really a black swan, somebody who wanted to reform this dictatorial system even as he rose to the top of it. And as I argue in the book, I don't think that Gorbachev's desires to reform were driven by Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev was not trying to keep up with the U.S. defense buildup. He, in fact, wanted to end the arms race and to spend money on social concerns. But I think Reagan's achievement was not in bringing Gorbachev to power or forcing the Soviet Union to reform. His achievement was in recognizing that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist leader, somebody he could do business with, as Margaret Thatcher told him. And they established a rapport at their first summit in Geneva in 1985 that I think changed history. And that allowed Reagan and Gorbachev to work together to reduce nuclear armaments and to peacefully end the Cold War. And I think that's, in many ways, the ultimate tribute to Reagan's pragmatism, because few would have expected that this hardline anti-communist who had been warning about the dangers of the Soviet Union since the 1940s, that he would be establishing a friendship with the world's number one communist and working so constructively with him. But that is, in fact, what Reagan did.
You mentioned Margaret Thatcher. They were great, great, great friends. And Brian Mulroney, those were the two leaders you identify as Reagan getting on famously with. I love the scene of Mulroney and Reagan singing When Irish Eyes Are Shining Together.
Right.
Is there a video of that, Max?
Probably. I'm not sure, but probably, yeah.
It'd be charming to listen to all these years later. Now, about the Soviet Union, there were two documents, National Security Document 32 and 75. That's his staff. That's not Reagan, because those are confrontational documents.
Yeah, those were produced by Bill Clark, his national security advisor for part of his first term, and they were confrontational. They called for a policy of confronting and bringing down the Soviet Union, but the actual implementation was much more varied. I mean, for example, one of the very first things Reagan did in 1981 was to lift the grain embargo that Jimmy Carter had imposed on the Soviets after the invasion of Afghanistan. So, you know, these national security documents are often cited as kind of a blueprint for bringing down the Soviet Union. And because the Soviet Union eventually fell a few years later, it's, you know, a lot of people try to draw a causal connection. But in fact, I think it's much more complicated than that. In fact, you know, I asked George Shultz, who was Reagan's Secretary of State, I said, Mr. Shultz, did the Reagan administration have a plan to bring down the Soviet Union? And he said, no, I wish we did, but we didn't.
Change in personnel is significant to flag here. The Chief of Staff, James Baker, for the second term goes to Treasury. And Don Regan, who is a Wall Street magnate, joins as Chief of Staff. And you make it very clear this, he might not be the worst Chief of Staff ever, but he's in competition. What didn't work?
Well, as Jim Baker said to me, Don Regan, who had been a former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Don Regan liked the chief part of the title, but he didn't understand that he was staff. And he really thought that he was the decision maker and not the president. And maybe that would have been okay if Regan had tremendous political instincts. But in fact, he had horrible political instincts. And, you know, as I mentioned, in many ways, the best decision of Reagan's presidency was making Jim Baker the White House chief of staff. In many ways, the worst decision was casually allowing Jim Baker and Don Regan to swap jobs at the beginning of the second term. That made no sense because Don Regan turned out to be this awful chief of staff who presided over one problem after another, ultimately culminating in the Iran-Contra scandal.
There are a number of problems that result from Don Regan's management. There are successes, too, and Max covers all this in great detail. I regret leaving out things, but I wanted to make sure that we mention Hezbollah. It's born at the Marine Barracks. Well, it's born at the U.S. Embassy bombing in 83 and then the Marine Barracks bombing in 83. That leads to dealing with Iran in an unusual fashion. Is there any way to characterize how Ronald Reagan thought of Iran? Did he think he could bring it in from the cold?
Well, unfortunately, the Reagan administration's dealings with Iran were a fiasco, not very unusual because that's true of many, many presidents since 1980. But yes, I mean, you know, he sent in the peacekeepers who were blown up at the barracks in Beirut in 1983, then pulled them out. But then what happened was Hezbollah, as the organization became known, began seizing American hostages. And Reagan was very exercised about the fate of the hostages. He wanted to get them out. And his then national security advisor, Bud McFarlane, suggested that there were these supposed moderates in Iran that we could deal with. We could ship them weapons. In return, they would release the hostages, and Iran itself would take a more moderate pro-American direction. And of course, this blew up in their face because the Iranians took the weapons, they released a few hostages, but then they seized more hostages. And then this moved from the realm of an unsuccessful policy to a great scandal when John Poindexter, who succeeded Bud McFarlane as national security advisor, and his aide, Oliver North, decided to take the profits from the sale of weapons to Iran and to funnel the profits to the Contras in Nicaragua, these anti-communist rebels, even though Congress had passed the Bullen Amendment forbidding aid to the Contras. And so this was a scandal that blew up in Reagan's face in 1986. He could have actually been impeached because of it, but ultimately his salvation was the fact that he was so hands-off. I mean, because he was so hands-off, he got into the scandal, but he also got out of it because his defense was, I did not know about the diversion of money to the Contras. Now, if Richard Nixon had said that, nobody would have believed them because everybody knew that Nixon knew everything that was going on. But with Reagan saying, I didn't know what was going on, it's very believable because everybody knew what a disengaged, hands-off manager he was. But this was kind of a near-death experience for the Reagan administration from which the president just barely emerged.
Philippines, Haiti, and South Africa. All it illustrate different parts of Reagan, especially about South Africa. He never spoke for the victims, or he did not speak for the victims of apartheid, clearly. Is that correct, Max?
Yeah, I think that's basically true. And as one of his own appointees pointed out to me, he had kind of a double standard because he spoke very eloquently about human rights violations by the Soviet Union and behind the Iron Curtain, but he was not so exercised about the human rights violations of apartheid, and in fact vetoed a very tough sanctions bill passed by Congress, and Congress wound up overriding his veto. So that was not a proud moment for the Reagan administration.
And I mentioned Manila because Paul Laxalt was a determinative. The Marcos dictatorship, all these decades later, Marcos is back in, but this time it's a descendant. There's a strong relationship with the United States. Haiti, 40 years later, it's worse than ever, Max. Did they have a chance after Duvalier left to solve that, or was it always going to be the anarchy we saw today?
Oh, gosh, it was probably always going to be a mess. But, you know, the fall of Marcos was interesting because, you know, Marcos tried to steal an election. There was a massive people power uprising. And initially, Reagan was very friendly to Marcos. He had known him since his time as governor of California. But he was then convinced by Paul Laxalt and George Shultz and others that Marcos could not stay in power. And this became part of a trend of Reagan promoting democracy and even willing to see the overthrow of right-wing dictatorships instead of simply highlighting the excesses of left-wing dictatorships. This was kind of the beginnings of a more pro-democracy agenda in the Reagan administration and the Republican Party.
The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Max Buda is the author. When we come back, farewell. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.